Well, I mean, what I would like to see is the plot extended in this way, where you have this agreement between the machines and the human city, but some of the humans sort of reject that agreement, and then it becomes a fight between the humans and the machines on the same side versus the humans who reject that agreement at all.
Of course, there would be it's like, you take any political party and you can find subsects within that party that are going to fight amongst that group. Exactly. That would be the next option, obviously. There's still going to be a group that's going to be the extremist, extreme humanists or whatever you'd want to call them, the extreme realists. I don't know what they would crazy term they could invent, but certainly it keeps going, and I wouldn't have a problem with the idea that there's still something there for that angle, but I just, like I said, there's a lot of inference that has to go on at the end, and it sort of leaves it open to whatever you want to make of it. And at the same time, it kind of lets certain thematic elements kind of go, like, and that's maybe as best as they could have done to be sort of st to still sort of tell maybe a storyline that is a little more different and maybe a little more profound. But in all that time that they had, I felt like there was a little more padding there that they could have cut out to maybe give us a greater through line in terms of like a bit of closure or a bit of whatever the theme or the idea really was going for there.
Well, I still think that the ultimate theme here is the necessity of a reconciliation between the human city and the machine city. So a lot of this padding, I think, is necessary for that. I think the scene where they're all dancing is necessary to show the sort of human solidarity, and sort of celebrating in exactly what it is that makes us human. And the thing is that it's really not all that attractive when you get down to it. I mean, the people there are all, thin and healthy and young, but apart from that, they're not really doing anything except sort of just dancing like animals, right? But that's what humans are, right? I think you can really only go so far with this idea of free choice as what's essential to humanity. I think that only takes you to this yes or no question: do you accept the Matrix or not? But it doesn't really go further than that. And that's sort of it. But on top of that, you have what's special about humanity. And what's special about humanity isn't that they can make this choice. They have to make this choice, but that's not what's worth celebrating about humanity. What's worth celebrating about humanity is exactly our flesh and blood and the fact that we're not digital machines, right? So this is why I think a lot of the visuals in the second and third movie are really great, right? So Zion is this sort of right, I mean, even so, I told you to look at that one discussion between Neo and the counselor when they go down to the engineering
They
room.
point out that even at that point they're still living off of machines, and then Neo makes a good point. Well, we can only shut these off and go do our it's like the extreme naturalist movement or something. We can always turn everything off and go live at Walden Pond, I guess.
I mean, except Neo's just wrong about that, because there is no place else to go. They have to live at the center of the Earth, because that's the only place
That,
to
that's
form.
because, yeah, that's the inference we're making, is they because we have we have we don't see all of the Earth. We just know that what we do see looks pretty dismal. And so there you go.
Right, so
if that's all that's left, then yeah, you're right.
so so so
They're
it requires
still connected to machines.
right so so and it requires this reconciliation. I mean, another thing that's weird about the second and third movies is that the machines really aren't the antagonists. The only real antagonist here is Smith, and Smith is this sort of classic, like I was talking about before, is this classic sort of Frankenstein thing where it's the machine sort of running amok, and you're unable to control it. Neo can't even control it. Neo has this big fight at the end, but the fight really doesn't amount to much, right? What's required there is for them to come together again. Smith is going to reject it, but in the same way that Neo rejects Smith, right? And so there's this sort of fundamental tension, and the only way of reconciling that is for them to come together. That's what happens with the human city and the machine city, and it's all about this reconciliation. The machines aren't antagonists. The architect, the oracle, they are, in a sense, almost rooting for humanity, because they don't want the cycle to repeat itself indefinitely. They want humans to make their choice, and then to accept that they have to make this choice, and that be the end of it. Even Deus Ex Machina at the very end is a little bit arrogant. It sort of lashes out at Neo when Neo comes and makes demands of it, but then it just accepts it. and you don't have this fight. The fight really isn't between humans and machines. The struggle is for reconciliation, and it's achieving that reconciliation on both sides, on the machine side and the human side. That's the difficulty, right? So really, the movie is just an exercise in diplomacy.
yeah. I mean, you're right. That's kind of probably another part of the letdown from most people coming from that first one. But I mean, the Smith character represents this sort of, he's turning everybody in the Matrix into another him. He's absorbing. I mean, that it's the Borg thing. He's assimilating, right. Turning everything into the same thing, eliminating choice, all that. And the Neo character was all about sort of freedom and kicking everything apart and all of that. And so, yeah, you're right. When they connect, you know, as the Oracle says, you're his opposite. So they kind of cancel each other out at the end there. And then everything is in a position to restart. So, and, like, the lesson is learned.
Right.
And the Architect, who I don't think the Architect had any desire. He just accepted there's this anomaly and this system has to restart. He would prefer not to have to do any of that. But it exists, and then the Oracle is the one that's saying, well, look, with this anomaly being part of humanity, maybe we can find a way to make it so that we can use the anomaly to prevent this from this perpetual cycle from happening.
Right.
And that's what she does. And then he says to her at the end, you know, that was quite a gamble you took, because she almost gets taken out by her own people.
Right.
You know, and that's why she changes her shell and all that. We know the actor died, and that's just
right.
That's
one of the real sort of tragedies about the third movie, is that the original Oracle was like perfect for that role, and the replacement Oracle her acting just was not up to snuff, and I thought she did a poor job. I thought that if they were gonna have to rewrite that role,
She was doing the same thing that the guy that played Smith in the real world was supposed to be doing, which was she was trying to parody that other person, which is always kind of tough when it's actually a different actual actor.
Right, but the guy who...
You know, like, right. it reads kind of hammy with the Smith guy, you know, like you can see he's talking
right.
This. And she's trying to use the euphemisms and all that stuff that the other actor was using, and I agree with you there, but I mean, I think a lot of that has to come down to probably just the way they were directed. They were like, okay, look, you are, in every mannerism and every way of speaking and behaving, this other person.
Right.
And so that's how you have to act. And as much as it's going to seem weird and artificial and strange, that should come from the fact that it should seem that way to somebody who's now seeing you in a different shell.
Right, right. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, you can't blame the actress for that. I thought the guy who did Smith in Zion was pretty good. I thought he did a good job of sort of...
Though his motivation was still always muddied, because it was like... In the second one, you see him with the knife, and he's about to run up and stab Neo in the back.
Right.
But then he decides not to when they all turn around.
Right.
And so then it's like if his only thing was like as a suicide bomber style to kill Neo, he could have done that at any point earlier on. But then I guess they kind of show that his other motivation could have been to set off the EMP. And I mean, really, there are definite holes in the plot, like why they didn't have an EMP in Zion to use, because that was the whole big deal at the end. It was like, oh my gosh, and then they set one off, obviously, and it screws them too, but it's like, there's certain things that kind of took me out of the movie, and that's just maybe me looking as a storyteller trying to find how good stories are constructed and sort of deconstructing that element of it. But there were certain things that seemed confusing to me about why they didn't have their defenses set up a certain way.
Right.
And all that.
I really thought that if they were going to change... I mean, if they had to get a new actor anyway, they should have just gone whole hog and have him be like a white cowboy or something. Like they should have just changed the Oracle entirely.
But part of that with the Oracle, I think... was because she was so human. I mean, she was in the same place. She was making cookies. She lived in the same house. Is that, you know, like that shell suited her, you know, forgive it, it suited her personality that she had developed in over whatever amount of thousands of years. Or I mean, Matrix is older than you think.
Right.
You know, so if this has happened six times or... then it probably is older than what Morpheus says in the first one.
Oh,
it's not probably 200 years in the future. It's probably like 3752 or some ridiculously late age. So, I mean, I think it makes sense that the Oracle would pick what she's comfortable in, you know, in as weird as it sounds. Because that's what she's supposed to be. She, like you said, she's supposed to be that side of the brain that is more touchy-feely.
Right, right. So I could talk more about the importance or the significance of the sort of reconciliation between humans and machines. I mean, this is exactly the sort of human-machine cooperation stuff that I talk about all the time.
And it's the stuff that's actually going on, the irony being it's going on multiple levels. In the first movie, it's pointed out explicitly in that conversation between the councilman and Neo when they look at the machines down at in the engineering level.
Right.
We're perpetually dependent on technology.
Right.
We always have been.
Right.
And we even, as much as they use it, not only in two ways, they use it in the first Matrix, but the people that man the gateways of Zion use it. They created their own little mini Matrix tower,
right?
Little station with all the white and everything.
Right.
They do Minority Report stuff where they move invisible things around and stuff.
I forget so ground control. Like,
yeah, exactly. So I latched onto that when I first saw the second one. Was just, well, look at that. You know, they're already creating, using the technology, and they use it to make the training programs and everything else.
Right.
So the reconciliation, yeah, it really just comes down to, like you said, it really just comes down to diplomacy. Just like, well, this right. War has been going on forever, and maybe it's time for it just to be over. And what is the end game? And neither side has really thought through what that means. Because for the humans, the end game is not the end of all machines, because like I said, they need some machines to survive. And for the machines, the end game presumably could be the end of all humans, but then they'd have to find some new power source, and presumably they could use the center of the Earth, like Zion. I don't know. I mean, these things, if you think too much about it, you realize that ultimately, I would say, a machine collective would figure a way out. You know, if the humans were this problem, they would just eliminate the humans completely and rely on a different source of energy. They could get it from a variety of different things. You know,
right.
Pig shit.
Right. Well, the Animatrix makes it clear that it was never the case that the machines wanted to eliminate humans. I mean, the first machines in that two-part Animatrix one where it's the machine war, the machines don't want to eliminate humans. They go to the UN diplomatically with the Apple.
It's very kind of like, it's pretty kind of hammy and cheesy, like the way the humans are so completely anti-machine, like to an insane level. But you're right, the machines really didn't want to, but then they did all of a sudden. I think they do turn in that second part when they black the skies. It's kind of like, okay, well then fine, we're gonna, because they don't leave some humans.
Wait.
They don't take like soldiers that were fighting them and turn them into the copper tops. They start raising whole crops, and there's never any discussion that there were humans that never got put in the Matrix. It sounds like all of them were put in the Matrix,
right.
And then some of them got freed, and then each cycle, and there was long enough that there were people like Tank and Dozer who got to be natural born within Zion,
they say.
But there was never like there was never any vestige of humanity left,
right.
When the machines decided very coldly, we're going to turn you all into our power,
right.
And by all of them, they end human civilization there. There's, in a strange way, there is humanity becomes kind of extinct from participating in its own free society at that point.
Right. And this is also designed to explain the scene in the first movie where once they free Neo, the machines actually take him and dump him out. The one scene in the first Matrix where he comes out of the pod and he's all without any hair. The machines help him get out of there, right? The machines sort of pick him up and throw him out for someone else to pick him up, right?
I've always found it very confusing as to whether or not the machine just identified like a broken pod and was just emptying the waste. You know, like, it seems weird that, like, or was that machine supposed to be working for the humans?
No, right. The idea isn't that the machines were working for the humans, but that the machines knew that this is part of just how the Matrix runs, is that sometimes people get rejected and you have to move them away, right?
Disconnect them.
Right.
But then they send things to come after you later and kill you. You know, the squids come later, I guess, to kill you. So it almost seems like that machine could just eliminate that person. That's the one part in the first movie, especially, that always sort of remains as sort of like a convenience. Is just that once he wakes up and he's freaked out and he's the most vulnerable he's ever going to be, a machine comes by and lets him go and flushes him. And I get a sense that the machine just can't, just doesn't distinguish him from anything other than dead trash or whatever.
Right.
And that's the only way that makes sense to me. I mean, I could kind of see your angle, but that requires that the architects and the machine world be a little more, like, ready to reconcile than they seem to be in the first movie, you know?
In the first movie, does Smith ever actually kill any of the humans?
I'm wondering. Yeah, I don't know if he himself does, but I know that a lot of, let's see, the little mouse kid gets killed when he gets all shot up, but that's like the cops and stuff.
Right, that's the cops. And then
Cypher kills a couple. Cypher kills a couple of people, and then I'm trying to think who Smith actually does wipe out in that first one, or if anybody. I'm not really sure. I don't think so. There's not a lot. It's not a huge. I mean, it sounds funny, but it's not a huge body count. I mean, there's all that insane gunplay towards the end, but even that doesn't really amount to a lot of dead bodies. It's like maybe 10 people or 15 people, because it's just more like mainly a lot of bullets, right, and chunks of columns collapsing and stuff.
Right.
It's a lot of sound and fury.
I have to think about that again, because Smith might not have killed anyone. But also it's the case that the agents don't really know what's going on either, right? The agents are just there to stop the humans from doing whatever. And in the first one, the agents are trying to get the access codes to Zion so that they can get in there and destroy it when they need to, just for the purposes of the cycle. But it seems like they really don't know what's going on either. Smith clearly doesn't know what's going on.
He's a frustrated middle management guy. Right. And, I mean, if you want to lay it out, Smith does. I mean, this at least goes to show to his motivation and to potential inference on backstory for him. He does pull out a gun and he does shoot Neo point blank and kill him, like he says.
Right.
So Neo, so the agents at least are equipped, Smith included, and perfectly willing to kill.
Yeah.
Humans that are, you know, the freed humans. I don't know. They don't have a good term for them, do they? Or is there a term from something for what the people like Neo and Trinity and all those people
for
are
for freed humans? Yeah.
Yeah. I guess you just call them goth kids. They wear the trench coats and all being awesome.
The trench coat mafia.
Yeah.
Mafia. I remember the year before I went out to college, 1999. This was the year that Columbine happened, and that Christmas, my mom got me the Matrix DVD, or no, it was still a VHS and a trench coat. And told me to make sure I don't kill anyone.
Good stuff.
And my parents also got me the sequels, which I have, but this is going to embarrass me in front of the Feudal Podcast listeners, but they're both...
All 10 of them, if any, right? It's going to embarrass you in front of you, if you're the only... Maybe Seth, if he still listens every now and again.
But the ones that my parents got me were the full-screen versions, the pan and scan versions, and because my parents don't know any better.
Yeah, that no one did back then, you know?
Do they... No, they still make those, don't they?
I think they're getting less and less frequent because more people are going to the HDTVs, you know?
Which are already widescreen, yeah.
Yeah, which are already that widescreen. I mean, you know, it's not the same aspect ratio, though. I mean, you know, people are going to be pissed when they buy a big, expensive TV, and then the Matrix has still got black bars on the top and bottom of it because it's not a 16:9 ratio. But, right, you know, you just gotta get around it, you know? Yeah. It's no big deal.
So I think the deep philosophical issue being... questioned in the Matrix sequels is really this question of reconciliation. However, it's dressed up with sort of two other issues that come right out of the first movie, and so two other sort of philosophical issues, and they're worth talking about for just a little bit. The first one is sort of what is reality, and the second one is this notion of choice. So we can take these both in turn. The first movie is a clear allusion to things like Descartes' Meditations and Plato's Allegory of the Cave and all these sort of classic philosophical texts about how do you know what reality is and how do you know that you're not just being fooled all the time. And The Matrix is supposed to be this example of it looks real and you can't tell the difference, but in fact everything that you think is true is not true.
But you know what it never does, but something like Existence does do, which maybe because Existence is sort of trying to be a little more philosophical, but at the same time it's not as caught up in a longer story order. But it never does that whole turnaround, like, are you sure we're out of the Matrix right now? You know, I mean, the people are all very, once they're freed, they're very self-righteous and very righteous about the fact that there is a clear reality and the Matrix is not that. There is a clear freedom, and that is being free from the Matrix. So at least in that first movie, like someone like Morpheus being representative of the sort of freed human society is kind of bolstering that whole idea that there is a sort of an objective sense that there is, you know, me in the real world, and there is this fake Matrix.
Right, right.
And that I think is going to the theme of the struggle, at least in the first movie.
Right, right, right. They get self-righteous and they also get very dogmatic about it. Right. So Morpheus is supposed to be this clear character where he's very dogmatic about his beliefs and he's very certain despite lack of evidence because he has this absurd belief, and in fact it ends up being wrong, right? I think this is one of the things that vindicates the second two movies, is that Morpheus ends up being wrong and all the religious imagery is,
well, it's like he's right but for the wrong reasons,
right,
that's
right.
A better way to think of it, because he's got this whole faith humanist thing and it turns out, well, no, you know, no one really knew, all that was bullshit, but we can still make things work, you know. And that's kind of what Neo ends up realizing in the second one, is like, you know, it's all crap, but I've got to do whatever I can do to see if I can stop this from happening.
And
I mean, a lot of it, like you said, is dealing with Smith. You know, he created Smith in a weird way. He's kind of like the Dr. Frankenstein to what is Smith, because Smith was working on that, you're right, just within the convolution of the Matrix. You know, he had already become his own kind of thing, taking the earpiece off,
right,
and being sick of it. But when Neo jumped into him and rewrote his programming or did whatever he did to him, you know, he became him and that sort of thing. It gave him some new level of complexity,
right,
that blew him out of the way and fucked everything up for everybody. So then he had to go do right by solving that problem.
That's right. And I think you're right, is that Morpheus was right, but for the wrong reasons. And I mean that's definitely a good way to put it.
But the key there is that his wrong reasons are thoroughly laid out as being wrong in those later movies, and I like that a lot. I mean, I identify a lot with, I don't remember his name, but the character that is like the head defense guy,
right?
Because for some strange reason, all the council people are kind of on board with Morpheus's like faith and trust in the Oracle stuff, and the one guy that's like trying to like actually be practical and like save everybody's ass is getting a lot of shit from them. He's like, if it were up to me, I would have everybody on the infantry holding a gun ready to defend our world. You know, and then the lead councilwoman, who strikes me as being kind of a, like, short-sighted bitch, kind of goes, well, I'm glad it's not up to you.
Right.
And then at the end, he was right, you know? At the end, they all are there with guns, you know? It's like, well, you know, I'm sorry. But, so, I mean, I think, I find him to be sort of a strangely sympathetic character in that. I don't know if he's supposed to just be sort of a weird foil to Morpheus, an antagonist,
right.
In a love triangle that thankfully they don't belabor us with drawing out or dealing with at all in the film.
Right. Commander Locke, I think is his name.
Yeah, Locke. It was the L. I was getting Locke and then Link. There's the guy from Oz. It's sort of the comedic relief to replace one of the dead guys that didn't die. One of them died, but the other guy didn't die in the first Matrix movie, but apparently he must have died in between them or something.
Or he survived just long enough to, I mean, that's one of the...
It's all petty minutia stuff, but we can get back, like you said, Morpheus was right for the wrong reasons, and that's all laid out in the second. And I agree with you. I love it when a movie will not hold itself up with these bullshit humanist crutches of faith and hope and all these like empty terms that don't really amount to anything. In the end, you have to go and do something to solve a problem.
Right. So two things about that. One of them is that the Wachowski brothers explicitly said in the run-up to the second movies, when it came out that they were making the second movies, they said explicitly that we're not going to just do a "Are we still in the Matrix?" thing. And so. Because you're right, that's still a lingering issue, but it would have been...
Well, no, I just mean in terms of that really, really getting into that philosophical like question of perception as reality and like all the stuff you were kind of talking about, it really doesn't care about that, I guess, that much.
Well, the thing is, you just really can't go that far with it. I mean...
Yeah, well, you can just kind of keep reinventing it and being like, are we there? No, are we out yet? Are we in? No. And you're right, it does get kind of tedious at a certain point. But they don't really deal with it at all to a degree. They kind of do at the beginning of the first movie. And then they're like, okay, yeah, this is the real world. This is not. and now we're going to tell different things. And that theme to me, or that philosophical issue to me, seems to kind of be like they're done dealing with that. I don't think they ever really get back to that too much.
The only point that they slightly get back to that is when Neo kills the Sentinels when they're chasing him, and Neo's clearly in the real world, and you're... And...
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that to me is sort of one of the other sort of flaw. I think still a flaw to me is in the logic of how that can happen. Because that's when, like... That's where they started to lose me a lot, because that's at the end of the second movie when he does that, right. And you're like, okay, so what, he's now got magic powers in the real world? Because the whole conceit of the first movie was that, here, we're gonna show you a bunch of crazy cool shit that people are gonna do, and the reason that it's not gonna be some crazy, like, idiotic fantasy sci-fi thing, or, you know, a magic thing, is because we made it up. It's all a computer game. It's all happening in the rules that can be bent in this magic computer game, you know?
Right.
And if you are really adept at dealing with them, like someone like Morpheus is, or Neo being the one, I guess, presumably is the most adept, then yeah, you're like a Jedi Knight, and you can, you know, pull sighs off the walls and all that
right,
shit.
Right, right. And they really didn't do a good job of explaining it. The idea is supposed to be something like Neo still has a presence or a power in the Matrix, even when he's outside of it. Doesn't really make that much sense.
And especially when you consider that they do a pretty good job in the third one of showing that there is a definite delineation for the machines between programs in the Matrix and, you know, like the architect, like the Merovingian, like the guy that's going there through the train system, and the machine world, you know?
Right.
So I see it as there being like a, there's a conduit. So because even if part of Neo's consciousness is within the Matrix still, I don't see how that gives him any effect on a machine that is in the outside world, other than some very long routed system of, he goes through the Matrix, through the like train interface system to the machine city, where those Sentinels are getting their, like, you know, orders.
Well, he doesn't go to the machine city through the Matrix. He has to actually fly there in the ship, right?
No. I mean, like, in terms of the logic of, right, him being able to, like, do the magic in the real world to shut,
right,
down the,
right,
squids.
Yeah, that just doesn't,
it's
make
like it, the, yeah, only, unless the squids are straight commanded, if they're considered agents of the Matrix in the real world, and I mean, it all comes down to all this like bureaucracy and logistics of how the machine world and the Matrix are, you know, is the architect, does the machine god in the real world of the machine city have like authority over the architect in the Matrix, and, you know, who's the top dog here, and who has control over the squids? Is it someone like, you know, you never really know all of that, so it kind of leaves it all open to interpretation and inference and all that, you know.
Right. So the other thing is about Morpheus being dogmatic. Part of, I think, the suggestion here, and this is never made explicit in the films, but I think part of the suggestion here is that in order for people to actually take their choice to be legitimate, you have to have this kind of sort of religious or spiritual or sort of mystical element to that choice, and that doesn't have to do with the choice itself being mystical, but just that in order for the one to appear and lead them through this next cycle, you have to have people like Morpheus who are strong believers despite evidence to the contrary, right? So you need both the Commander Locke, who are the sort of hardcore pragmatists, and you need the idealistic spiritualists like Morpheus. So I was watching this lecture the other day that Lolly linked me to from an anthropologist who was arguing that religious sentiments generally in human populations are a mild form of schizophrenia. And the idea is that
that's the new thing these days, right? It's all hardcore militant atheism going on in the background, right? It's like so now if you're religious, it's opiate of the masses, right?
Well, I mean the opiate of the masses thing, you have to be careful about, right? Marx didn't mean that.
You have to be careful with calling religious people schizophrenics too. I mean, I don't know what that's all about either, right?
It's not schizophrenia, right? So schizophrenia, at least according to this lecture, I'll link you to the lecture so you can put it on the website or something. It was pretty interesting, right? So schizophrenia lies on this spectrum, and at the extreme end, you have sort of hardcore schizophrenics like Charles Manson or someone like that. But it lies on a spectrum, and you have a weak, at the other end of the spectrum, you have a sort of weak type of schizophrenia, which is called schizotypalism, Which
so he's drawing religion as an analogy to a type of schizophrenia. Okay, I get it then. He's not trying to say it's like schizophrenia. It's just like a lot of belief systems. There's a spectrum to it.
Right.
Morpheus is on one end and Locke is on another.
Not belief systems. Sort of mental disorders. The mental disorder here is on a spectrum, where at the extreme end you have sort of schizophrenia, which can be completely debilitating, where you can't actually sort of function properly. But then you have mild forms, which are schizotypalism, which he was just making the case that look, if you look at people who are sort of evangelical religious people who believe that they can speak in tongues or that they have these sort of religious experiences, these are all in a clinical context, these are exactly the sort of symptoms of a kind of mild form of schizophrenia, schizotypalism, which is just a mild form of schizophrenia. It's sort of a high-functioning thing. And the argument is that, look, in human history, for humans to survive in the kind of societies they have, you need some people like this. Everyone can't be like this, but you need some people like this. You need to have your shamans, you need to have your Morpheus relying on prophecy people.
The people with the vision quest.
People with
the
vision quest, because it organizes and leads and unifies everyone else. If everyone was acting like that, then society wouldn't function. You need a few of them that are like that and that people trust. So you can't have a whole lot of them.
They'd be considered an anomaly or a mental disorder because of their belief system then, or because of the way they behave? So then it gets into like anything that's outside of the norm, homosexuality and all those other sorts of things, they become the anomaly, the aberration from the norm, and you need a percentage of this in order for society to work or whatever, because basically it's worked so far with a percentage.
Homosexuality isn't a mental disorder, but
well, it's a different kind of disorder, right? If you're going from some kind of a status from it, right? I mean, if you're defining, like, you know, a mental disorder has to do with where someone stands based on, you know, you're defining sanity, right? So there's a norm of behavior, and then there's things that deviate from that to different degrees, and so then that's how you define whether or not something's an aberration. An aberration is an aberration.
Well, it doesn't have to be an aberration.
There's political connotation and all that stupid shit.
It doesn't have to be an aberration, right? So if someone's speaking to bushes, if someone thinks a bush is speaking to them, right? You can sort of understand that relative to a norm. Most people don't hear speaking bushes, and this person does, so they're an aberration. But you can also just say that, look, this is the kind of behavior that is indicative of a certain kind of mental disorder without sort of an explicit comparison to a norm.
So we're getting off topic. Let's focus back on. So basically, you need a percentage of people that are like that, I guess.
Right, for the system to function, and that's really why Morpheus is he's not the protagonist of the movies, but he's really the person that drives the plot of all the movies, because he has these strong beliefs and because he can unify people. Right. So the speech that he gives,
you need the diehard believer. You need the optimist. I guess in a weird way is kind of what he serves as. He's the eternal optimist based on his faith in whatever.
Right. And the scene where he gives his speech in the cave sort of chokes me up a little. I mean, Lawrence Fishburne is just a really good actor, and you know, he's a classically trained sort of Shakespearean actor also, right? And so he can sort of lay down that speech really well, and you can get behind him. Also, in that speech, he's not really appealing to any of these beliefs that he has, and he sort of explicitly says, "Am I not afraid because of the beliefs I have? No, it's because of where we've been and what we've come through and this kind of stuff, right? And it's supposed to be this bonding moment of humanity. And the idea is something like you need a Morpheus type character in order to bond humanity like that.
Yeah. He's a politician. You know, he's got blind optimism, and he's gonna throw out some rhetoric that says we're great and we're strong. We've done it before. We can do it again.
Right.
And then the pragmatist like Locke is kind of like, we need to figure out how to actually do it. And then he's like, don't worry, I've got faith, the Oracle, blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, no, that was all. And then Neo's kind of like, oh, that was all bullshit. Sorry, but I'm going to go see what I can do. And then the other guy's kind of like, well, okay, let's make shells.
Right.
And so yeah, it does you know, it does kind of show how the ever optimistic politician and to the same degree the sort of the council members ultimately don't have what it takes to solve anything, but things do get solved through the people that do.
Well, but they're still a necessary part of it, right? The people.
Yeah. I mean, they are. Only insofar as there are other people there that if it were just them, then I think there would have been problems.
Right. So this is one of the things that this anthropologist says in this lecture is that, look, it's good that we have one shaman, but if we have two, that's a bad thing, right?
More like if we have too many, it's a bad thing. I mean, we could have 10 or 15 for all we care. It's about how much how diluted that becomes within a system.
Well, in the movie, no one else really believes what Morpheus believes. Link says, "Look, I've seen some things that make me think that Morpheus is probably right, but still, who knows? We're just gonna see it through." If Commander Locke is the pragmatist, then Link is sort of the realist, right?
Sort of. I mean, he's more of the comedic relief. Well, he does get that thing. He gets that trinket from his wife, which is, I don't know, maybe a whole different sort of religious thing that they never get into. And he's like, I don't believe. But then he puts it on later. So he kind of gets turned to a degree. Trinity believes in pretty wholeheartedly in the Oracle. And even Niobe at one point goes to see the Oracle and sort of follows her. I'm the most surprised, and I think it's just sort of a bit of lazy writing, or I don't know what, that most of the council people seem to be kind of on Morpheus's angle. You know, especially Hammond or whatever, the guy that usually plays, like, evil guys in movies, which is just so weird that he ended up not, like, turning in this movie. The guy that Neo's having the conversation with about the machines, you know, he hears, you know, Morpheus talking about what he thinks is going on, and he's like, okay, well, you know, and he invites him to be the one to speak at the big count, at the big temple meeting.
So
I get the impression that that it's not, I mean, Morpheus may be the sort of like front runner for this belief system that some other people kind of have and other people don't necessarily share, but it's not, it doesn't seem to marginalize him or anything. If nothing else, it seems to kind of put him, it seems to elevate him.
Right. Well,
it elevates him in the eyes of the people at the temple. Right. It elevates him in the eyes of the council.
Right.
The only person that's kind of left seeming petulant is the pragmatist Locke. He's kind of like, well, okay, you're going to take six more of our ships or however many of our ships you think you need for this belief system based little excursion, while I'm saying this is the real facts on the ground situation.
The counselor only believes him because it motivates the people, right? It gets the people all sort of unified and dancing.
Yeah, it's an opiate of the masses type.
Oh yeah, yeah. So you have to be careful about Marx here. So Marx says that it's the opiate of the masses, but he doesn't mean this as a criticism. Opium was basically the only pain relieving drug that people had at the time, and
yeah, but then it had such a positive connotation at the time.
Sure. Absolutely. It was. I mean, if you were going to have any kind of surgery,
was this the opium dens and all that where people would go to?
You had the opium dens too, but you also had just
trade in debauchery and whatnot.
But opium had serious sort of medical uses. Still does. But at the time, it was the only real thing that they had for pain relief. It wasn't just a negative.
So yeah, it is all. It's all about pain relief. No, I'm not saying it's. I'm not using it in a negative.
Right.
I'm using it in a very. I mean, maybe it's cynical, but I don't know. It's kind of hyper cynical because I'm like over the connotation of being cynical about it. I'm saying, well, like that's just the truth. You know, these people were all gonna die. You know, they might as well have a good time up until it happens.
Right.
So it makes perfect sense. But at the same time, you don't just throw in the towel. You know, you do try to solve a problem. You do try to come up with a solution. And that's why, you know, someone like the way Neo's behavior is, and especially the way Locke's behavior is, are things that, like, I enjoy. I mean, because they're like, you know, they're not just going to let this system do what it's going to do. They're going to be an active part to try and get a result that ideally will benefit their society or their world or whatever, you know?
Right.
Because, you know, pain relief can also come through the lack of pain.
So what do you think, Ian? If you were given the choice to stay in the Matrix or to exit the Matrix,